rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends. Happy Friday to you. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, end of the week, whatever it is for you. Happy Friday. Hope you have a great weekend. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. We have a new podcast link, by the way, at tomhartman.com. If you just simply go to tomhartman.com and click on the word podcast, it's several different places there on the homepage. It takes you to a brand new podcast stream that whiterosesociety.org is offering, also through Apple iTunes. So just so you know that that's available. It's the last day of the week. It's the day that it's Friday, the day that we always start our three-hour program with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, reelected seven times to the House of Representatives, the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives in its independent member of the House of Representatives in its history, the only member of the House of Representatives who is neither Democrat nor Republican. He is an independent, a man who stands for himself and, in my opinion, stands for America. I think of Bernie Sanders as America's congressman. His website, house.bernie.gov or bernie.org. Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And let me just toss in for our listeners, if you want to call, if Bernie likes to take your calls and questions, and we'll get into that as we get into the program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States. Outside the United States, 802-248-0620. And we'll take your calls and questions. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, click on live chat. Bernie, we had an election in Ohio here last week, speaking of national issues, or this week, rather.
Well, what it was is a special election to replace Rob Portman, who is now the trade representative for the president. And what was interesting about that election is that that is a very, very solid Republican district. And yet, despite spending a whole lot of money and running their usual campaign of personal destruction, the Republican candidate barely eked out a victory. Now, I don't want to read too much into it because, you know, local elections deal with local personalities and so forth. But my guess is that that election is indicative of the fact that the American people more and more are catching on to the fact that our country is being run by right-wing extremists who day and night work on behalf of the wealthiest people and the largest corporations and ignore the needs of the middle class and working families. And I think we are seeing in issue after issue, area after area, a gradual shift in the politics of this country away from Bush and in favor of those of us who are trying to represent ordinary Americans. You know, I know that the president recently signed this CAFTA agreement, and it was a big deal. He made this big deal about it and so forth and so on. The fact of the matter is, in my political view, it was a loss for the president. Because in order to win the CAFTA vote by two votes, by keeping the rolls open a whole hour after regular voting time, they won that despite the vice president being almost on the floor of the House a few hours before the vote, twisting arms, the president coming to Capitol Hill, Republican leaders threatening to withhold transportation projects for Republicans who would vote against CAFTA, Republican leadership threatening members that they're not going to become committee chairman if they voted against CAFTA. Despite all of that, Tom, despite the Chamber of Commerce and big business saying they're going to withhold campaign contributions to people who voted against CAFTA, they won by two votes.
And so, which means a lot of Republicans voted against CAFTA.
Absolutely, and more would have without the pressure. But the point is, in what amounts to a relatively insignificant trade agreement, they had to pull out all of the stops. And to my mind, that vote was not only a referendum on our disastrous trade policy, it was also a statement that the economy for the middle class, for working families, is not going as well as the Bush administration keeps touting. And most of the members of Congress understand it. They want changes in our trade policy and in other policies. So I saw that, you know, while Bush will present it as a great victory, I don't really see it as a great victory. And I my guess is that's going to be a long time before they bring up another trade agreement. But the point is, I think there's a gradual political shift in this country, away from our right-wing extremist friends who run this government, and in favor of folks who want to protect the environment, change our trade policy, deal with some of the serious crises facing the middle class.
You know, it seems to me, Bernie, that what we're seeing is something not that different from 94. And where I differ, and I'd love to get your take on this from other people who comment on this, in 94, the Democrats started slipping nationally. And what they're suggesting, you know, what the right-wingers on TV, which is almost all of the commentators on TV are suggesting is that the Democrats were slipping because they were too left in 94 with Clinton. And the reality is that the Democratic Party started moving to the right under Bill Clinton with the DLC, I think that's why they started losing in 94, and I think the Republican Party has moved to the right, and that's why they're losing, too.
I think the cry, at least in the House in 1994, is you had the Democrats had been controlled that institution for many, many, many decades, and the Republicans were saying it's time for a change. Well, you've got these right-wing guys having controlled the House now for the last 11 years, and now they also control the White House, they control the Senate. And I think that people in this country are concerned about the direction of America in a number of different ways. You know, Tom, just sit back for a minute and look at the major problems facing the country. Just be an objective guy. You're a taxi cab driver. Look at health care. Healthcare system is disintegrating. More and more people uninsured. Cost of healthcare going up. What is the Bush administration's solution? Virtually nothing at all of any relevance. Look at veterans issues. The president talks constantly about his love for the troops, and yet he is grossly underfunding veterans' needs. Waiting lines all over this country. Veterans organizations are saying very clearly that the Bush administration is ignoring the needs of our veterans. When you go to the gas pump and you fill up your car, what are you paying? You're paying $2.35, depending on where you live in America. Huge increase in the price of gas, and that is a real burden, economic burden, especially in rural America and the state of Vermont. You know, many people travel 50, 100 miles every day to and from work. That's money coming right out of their paycheck in order to pay for gas. What has Bush done about it? He doesn't even talk about it. And there's a lot of things that can be done about it. Environment. Millions of Americans, vast majority of the people concerned about global warming, concerned about the environmental problems facing our country and the world. Bush administration continues to move in a radically anti-environmental policy. So you look at the issues out there. Prescription drugs. You know, there's going to be a prescription drug program coming down. A lot of seniors are going to be learning about that program. They're going to be very disappointed because for most of them, they're going to be very little in the way of reducing the outrageously high prices that they have to pay because that bill was written by the pharmaceutical industry. And on it goes. So you just look at the issues. Jobs. What kind of jobs are we creating in America? Well, we're creating Walmart-type jobs. Our trade policy is losing good-paying jobs. People very concerned about that. So I think as people look at the real problems facing America, and of course the media does not do a terribly good job in focusing on that, they're going to find that either the Bush administration ignores them or is on the wrong side of them. And the end result is that last year, the CEOs of the Forbes 500, largest corporations in America, you know what their increase in compensation was last year?
It was substantial.
54%.
Yeah.
I would think that that's pretty substantial. Most of the people who are listening to this program were lucky if they did better than inflation. If they held their own, they did well. Many people are working longer hours for low wages. CEOs of large corporations, 54% increase. Gap between the rich and the poor growing wider. So I think that that perception is getting out there, and I think we're seeing that our right-wing extreme friends who are now running the White House, the Senate, and the House are losing their support.
And meanwhile, our young men and women are in Iraq are dying, and,
yes,
and in record numbers.
Yes, that is, I mean, well, we all know what happened in the last week. I think it was 22 Marines have been killed in just the last 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I have a question about that, Bernie. When Don Rumsfeld went over to Iraq last week or the week before last, he was ferried around in what's called a Rhino, this heavily armored vehicle that actually could have withstood one of these blasts. However, it was owned by Halliburton because the Army doesn't have them. Halliburton has them. When the governor of the state that I'm in now, in Oregon, Ted Gulengoski, went over there a few months ago, he was ferried around in an armored Mercedes. He said it was so heavy it took 3 guys to close the door. He was making a joke, but, you know, nearly that. And it was owned by one of the independent contractors, the second largest army in Iraq, over 20,000, maybe as many as 40,000 people, independent contractors. And these guys are being paid $100,000, $150,000 a year. They have no problem having armored vehicles. It's all being done with our tax dollars. Why aren't our tax dollars being used to armor the vehicles of the kids who are in the Marine Corps, the Army, and the Air Force?
Well, that's the question that many people are asking. And the answer is pretty obvious. that among many other things, the Bush administration, which distorted the information and got us into the war on false pretenses, was also grossly unprepared for what, in fact, has happened for the last several years. I mean, I think Cheney and friends thought this would be a quick war, that what they compared it to the liberation of Paris during World War II. And yet, if you read the news reports now, the fear, the horror is, according to the U.S. military, is that the insurgents are becoming more sophisticated, they're developing more powerful weaponry, and we're not prepared for that.
Well, I was going to say, we've been there now longer than we were in World War II. During World War II, we went from having no military-industrial infrastructure, as Dwight Eisenhower pointed out in his farewell address in 1961. We had literally no military-industrial complex before World War I started, to having a powerful military infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, in other words, the ability to arm our troops. We sent our soldiers over well-armed, well-armored during World War II. We've been in Iraq longer than we were in World War II. These guys are absolutely incompetent.
Well, they are incompetent in a lot of reasons. They're incompetent in delivering the kind of equipment that our soldiers need in terms of armor and so forth. There's a lot of corruption that's going on. There's a lot of money that is missing. But they are also, and I think the major criticism is, incompetent in anticipating what would happen. I mean, when you look at these Downing Street memo, it's not just the argument that the British told us that Bush and his friends, quote-unquote, fixed the intelligence in order to correlate with their goal of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. They also mentioned that these guys were not prepared. There was an amazing lack of preparation for what might, in fact, happen. And that's what we're seeing today.
Yeah. Plus, back in the 1940s, we still had industrial infrastructure in the United States. We still had tool and die shops. We still had steel mills. We still had the ability to make tanks on a moment's notice. We could turn on a dime and turn to a war footing. And we can't do that anymore because the Bushies have given all this away to China.
Well, it's not just Bush, but this has been happening for a number of years. And that raises the very, very, very deep issue that more and more we're becoming a service-oriented nation, not producing real products. And certainly, as you've just indicated, we are losing our capability to defend, to manufacture the military equipment that we need. And one of the very scary things is that in terms of our relationship with China, it's not just that we have a $160 billion trade deficit, not just that we're losing good-paying jobs, but we are transferring technology to China, which is going to significantly increase their military capabilities, and yet your point is valid. We're having it harder and harder to produce the products we need to defend ourselves.
Yeah, and this is a real problem for the United States. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie, our regular Friday session, the only regular guest on this program, and I am so honored to have you, Congressman Sanders. It's been over a year, I think, we've been doing this. It's absolutely great. And so if you have a question for Bernie Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. It's Congressman Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, our regular Friday afternoon session. And Congressman Sanders, Kevin in Georgia is on the line with you. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Congressman Sanders, I love this part of the – I love Fridays for this reason, just a chance to hear you talk.
Thank you.
My question is, why is it so hard to get a complaint against any of these corrupt congressmen? Right now, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington have written up all the papers to file a complaint against Cunningham, and you know he probably took a $700,000 bribe from a military industrialist. At least for the House thing. You heard about that from San Diego.
Yeah, of course.
And Congressman Ney, a year after delay, did the exact same golf trip. And yet no one will file an ethics complaint against these guys. Obviously, both parties are dirty. That's why you're the perfect man, since you belong to neither party.
Well,
you're not beholden to anyone, are you?
To my wife, I guess. But
well, there you go.
But I but as you know, by the way, Duke Cunningham has announced that he's not seeking re-election.
Okay.
Yeah, he is not going to be running for re-election. And I think, to answer your question without getting into specifics, the real corruption in Congress that goes on is the degree of dependency of members of Congress on big money interests. And what I can tell you, Kevin, is if you look at legislation that comes down the pike, almost all of it is paid for by special interests. We just recently passed the so-called energy bill in which $9 billion in corporate welfare went to the oil industry, which is enjoying record-breaking profits. They need that corporate welfare like a hole in the head to coal companies, to nuclear power companies. If you look at the bankruptcy bill, it was the credit card companies that paid for it and the banks that paid for it. If you look at CAFTA, it was almost all of the major corporations who pay for it. The issue in this country right now is the degree to which the Congress, the White House, are owned and controlled by big money interests. And it causes just a huge sellout of the interest of the middle class in America. And that's what we've got to keep banging away.
So you're suggesting that the accountability that we have to hold members of Congress to is by we the people, by virtue of their being sold out, rather than you guys pointing the finger at each other?
I think ultimately that is the issue, is money rules in Congress. Now, having said that, let me tell you, there are dozens and dozens of people who are struggling hard. Some of them are Republicans who are trying to stand up for the middle class in this country. But when I mentioned earlier that in terms of the right in the newspapers, Chamber of Commerce says they are going to withhold campaign contributions for those Republicans who vote against CAFTA. Well, how much more blatant can you be? We remember going way back when Bush first got in, those secret energy meetings that took place with Vice President Cheney. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Where all of the big energy companies were. Well, guess what just passed a couple of weeks ago? It was their energy bill paid for by big money. So after all is said and done, the most important issue that we've got to focus on, and what the real corruption going on, is the degree to which big money controls the legislative process in Congress.
Okay. We have a little less than a minute. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky, probably enough time for you to ask a question. Bernie can pick it up on the other side.
Okay. My question is real quick, that why doesn't anybody point out to the service people or to the American population that by Bush wholesaling industries out, that these servicemen that we're asking to go fight for us, when they come back, they're not going to have any decent paying jobs.
Well,
we need to be more supportive of them that way. Also, too, why didn't anybody call Bush a traitor? Because basically what he's doing is he's selling the country out, wholesaling it out.
Well, you've got 20 seconds, Bernie.
All right, Dennis raises good points. Not just, Bush supports what the CEOs of large corporations, who are more and more open about saying it. What they are saying, our future is in China. Our future is in countries around the world, not in the United States of America. And that is an issue that should be banged away at. And certainly Bush supports those efforts.
Supports the outsourcing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a big, big problem. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our regular Friday session, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. We'll be taking your calls, 1-866-889-8894, when we come right back from this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends. Taking care of business here, Tom Hartman with you on Friday afternoon. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie, our regular session with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our program, by the way, brought to you by Small Dog Electronics. High technology at low prices. Their telephone number, toll-free, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. For all things Macintosh or all things computer of any sort of help you need, any sort of service you need, any sort of products you want to buy, give them a shot. 1-800-511-MACS, 1-800-MAX. Small Dog Electronics. Supporting this program for coming up on 2 years now, I'd say. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman with you. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Scott in San Diego's on the line. Hey, Scott, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Bernie, congratulations. It's your face on the cover of The Nation magazine. The article is entitled, Being Like Bernie. It's quite a story about you and where you've come from.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. It raises one question. In the article, it said that you so far have raised $800,000 to $900,000 to run your campaigns. But in the senatorial race, the article points out that you may have to raise $5 million, five times what you've normally raised.
Yes.
How are you going to do that and keep a clean campaign?
Well, our way of raising money has historically been very different from the vast majority of the members of Congress in that we have raised money from tens and tens and tens of thousands of people in Vermont and throughout this country who contribute small contributions. Do we get some large contributions? Yes. Do we get help from labor unions and environmental groups and women's groups and groups representing children? Yes, we do. But historically, where we have gotten our money is from small individual contributors by the tens of thousands. And our website, by the way, if anyone is interested, is www.bernie.org.
So that's your plan? You're going to stick with it?
Well, that's our plan. We're going to stick with it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where we'll end up getting most of our funds. But Peter is right. Running a campaign in this day and age, you need, unfortunately and tragically, huge sums of money.
David in Allentown, Pennsylvania on the line. David, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Congressman, with all due respect, I do not see this momentum change that you're talking about in the Democratic Party. I mean, and to say that, I think you're setting up a false sense of reality in the people. These elections have gone 50-50 for some time now, and these people are able to manipulate at will when it comes to crunch time in any election, either with money or with setting up, security measures that are allowing people to have a false sense of what's going on and scaring the hell out of them. I don't see it. I don't see the momentum change. I don't see the Democrats getting loud. I see him squashing Howard Dean when he gets loud. I don't see this at all, sir.
Stay on, David. I mean, my point was I used the Ohio election as an example because that was a district which was very, very heavily Republican.
They barely won. For Clinton.
Oh, no. That went certainly in the last election, it went overwhelmingly for Bush.
Yeah, it did in the last election, right?
Yeah, and that's only a year ago. The other thing, I think if you look on issue by issue, whether it's Iraq, whether it's the economy, what you find is Bush's support is sinking big time. This guy is one of the least popular presidents, given how long he has been in office since they've been doing polls. The weakness, I would think, where I would agree with you, is I don't see a huge amount of support for the Democrats, but I see ebbing support. I see a drop in support for the Republicans. And
but
I think
Congressman,
that, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I just think he has been able to get his agenda passed. They've been able to bust the unions. I suspect Rupert Murdoch has something to do with that if you look at his history, busted the unions back in England. But I see the Republican Party or the Democratic Party still in the lamb mode. And the old analogy, and I'll get off and let you respond. The old analogy is, if you get what you want by being meek like a lamb, move on to being foxy like a fox or a blue eye. And if that doesn't work, start roaring like a lion. And if you have to, bite their head off like a serpent. The Democratic Party is still in the lamb mode, and they can't seem to get out of it. There's a big split in the Democratic Party to me. I mean, almost 50-50.
All my point was is I see the president and right-wing extremism losing support. Does the Democratic Party have to get its act together? Do they have to focus on the needs of the middle class? Do they have to be prepared to stand up to corporate America and big money interests, be very clear on what they stand for? Absolutely. Have they done it? And some of them have. Many of them have not.
Yeah, thank you, David, for that call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Nancy in Morgantown, West Virginia on the line. Hey, Nancy.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Great.
Okay, I was at the presentation in St. Louis at the media conference.
Uh-huh.
And in answer to a question to you about whether it was appropriate now to impeach Bush,
right,
you responded that we had to be concerned about who would take his place, obviously.
Among other things, yes.
Among other things. My question to you about that, though, is how about using the Nixon-Agnew model and getting Cheney out of there first with his Halliburton connections and so forth, and then go after Bush?
You see, Nancy, my view is, if you think that the kinds of changes this country needs are going to take place in Washington today, with a Republican White House, Republican Senate, Republican House, Republican Supreme Court. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to have to take place at the grassroots election. I think we have got to put our energy into the elections and take power away from the Republican Party. And I think talking about impeachment and other things deflects energy from the grassroots organizing that we have to do. And that is my view. I think we need to build just a mass amount of effort at the grassroots, get people involved in the political process. That's the way we're going to bring about long-term change.
Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate the call. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Armin in Florida on the line. Hey, Armin.
Hey, how you all doing? Hi, Bernie.
Good.
How are you?
Good.
Hey, the question I have is, there's a really good article on the pilotonline.com, and it's, the article is GOP pays tribute to Pat Robeson. Pat Robeson is going to get exits in that transportation bill, and he doesn't even have the roads built yet for the need. And is that outrageous or not?
That is outrageous, absolutely. I mean, Pat Robeson, yeah.
And here's the question I have. In my observation, why do the people out here in America that pray to God seem to do far better when they add a little money and campaign contributions to it?
Good question.
Well, I think you're raising what is going on politically in America, in my view, is a very successful effort on the part of the Republican Party to bring big money together. Big money is the major force behind what's going on. And they're teaming up with right-wing fundamentalist religious organizations, Pat Robeson being one of them. And the reward that many of these religious organizations are getting is federal funding for their and being able to deliver services through their churches.
It was over $1 billion last year, was it not?
Yes, I think
faith-based
right.
initiatives. Yeah.
So I think this kind of effort of the combination of big money, which really calls the tune, and working with people like Pat Robeson is the heart and soul of where the Republican Party is right now. But again, even in that area, I think you're seeing more and more religious people standing up and saying, wait a minute, if you talk about moral issues, what about having in this country the highest rate of childhood poverty, people sleeping out on the street, the gap between the rich and the poor? Is this moral? And I think you're beginning to see some movement in that direction away from just the issues that some of these people talk about.
Okay, thank you, Bernie. Tony in San Diego, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Congressman, it's an honor to speak with you.
Nice to meet you, Tony.
You mentioned earlier, and I agree with you, that the Bush administration is definitely pushing our outsourcing of our jobs over to China. But I also feel that the American public is complicit in this because we're just going in droves to Walmart to buy products that are all made in China. There was a day back in the 90s when Walmart used to actually advertise saying, we sell things only made in America.
Right.
And that disappeared. And so my question is there any conversation inside Congress about how to instill pride in buying American, that it's okay to pay more money for something because it was made in America, and saying, hey, Chinese, screw you guys. We don't need your stuff. We're willing to pay more for that item because we made it here.
Well, the efforts, for example, we introduced legislation through in the Export-Import Agency appropriations that would take money away, take loans and grants away from those corporations which are outsourcing our jobs and provide help to small businesses and medium-sized businesses in the United States that are growing jobs. So to answer your question, some of us are trying to work in that direction. I'll give you one example. Recently, the Export-Import Bank decided to give $5 billion to a company that is, in fact, owned by the British government that's going to be building nuclear power plants in China. Some of us think it would make a lot more sense that to be providing help to small businesses in America. So the answer, Tony, some of us are trying to do that.
Thanks for that call, Tony. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Carol in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the line. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoy your show. Been listening ever since you got on WPTT in Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you.
And I really enjoy Fridays with Bernie. And I'm wondering if Bernie would consider running for president in 2008.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. But
I
I'm
would vote
be...
for you immediately.
Thank you. I'm going to be running for the Senate. That's where I would love to be representing Vermont. But thank you very much.
Not the president. Huh?
Not the president.
Sorry, Carol. thanks for the call and thanks for your kind comments. 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
Hey, Rick, you're live and on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Good day, gentlemen. And Bernie, I hope you're enjoying the August recess.
Yeah. Thank you.
What I wanted to ask you was, and maybe this isn't in keeping with the rest of the topics, but I'm kind of following this John Roberts nomination that Bush made. And I noticed something in the news yesterday, and maybe it's a small item, but one never knows. Apparently Mr. Roberts gave some money to a gay rights group. Now, I guess the twofold question I would have is that going to make him somewhat anathema in certain right-wing circles, and is it conversely going to say to the liberals, maybe this guy isn't so bad after all? What do you think?
Probably the latter.
Yeah,
probably
actually, for both of you, he didn't give money to a gay rights group. His law firm does pro bono work, and they did some pro bono work for a group that was advocating for gay housing rights, anti-discrimination against gays and housing, which is the law in some states. And his law firm did that pro bono work, and he was one of the lawyers who was involved in that.
So does that make him a somewhat better guy than we might think, or...?
Well, I think that's what the effort in getting that stuff in the newspaper is about. Clearly what you got is a very conservative guy, but this is not some kind of Yahoo. This is a very bright guy. He was on Harvard Law Review, very articulate, very smart. I think what is incumbent upon the Senate Judiciary Committee is really to ask him very difficult, polite, but pointed questions about whether or not he intends to overturn, among other things, Roe versus Wade. What his views, his judicial philosophy is. Huge issues out there other than abortion. Let me tell you, that is the proper role of government in a modern society, whether we do away with that and we let corporations do whatever they want to do, whether we protect the needs of workers, whether we protect our environment, some very important issues that have to be discussed with him.
Thank you. 1-866-889-8894. Trey in North Carolina on Sirius. Hey Trey, what's up?
Yeah, I have a comment. I think one of the biggest problems that the Democrats face is the level of ignorance in this country. Because I was looking at some study by the National Geographic Society, and like 85% of like Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 couldn't even find Iraq on a map. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, a problem for them, since they would be the main ones to be sent over there if there was a draft or anything. And also, like Thomas Jefferson, you know, he said that if a nation is supposed to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, space where there was never can be. So I think that when you have so many people in this country who don't even know who Hillary Clinton is, as you can see, you know, every time Jay Leno goes out and jaywalk, and they don't even know most of this stuff, and it's kind of hard to expect them to be able to see the wrong that the GOP
does.
That's right. Because they don't, you know.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's no question that there is a lot of general ignorance in this country. Our people are smart people, but they just don't know a lot about what is going on. And I think I would put the critique there, not only in schools, because it's easy to criticize schools, I put it right at the media. I mean, somebody makes the decision that we're going to hear all about Michael Jackson, and we're going to hear all about every other celebrity in America, and yet we're not going to have serious discussions about the important issues facing the American people, serious discussions about the history of the United States, where were we, where do we come from, where are we going. That's stuff that is not on television, by and large. But unless we raise public consciousness, political consciousness, so we can have intelligent debates, so the people do not fall for negative character assassination 30-second ads or 6-second sound bites. And I think, you know, the very positive thing that shows like this do, that Tom Hartman and other progressives do, is allow the American people to have serious discussion about serious issues that the corporate media very often prefers not to have on the air.
Susan in Santa Cruz, listening on KXRA. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Bernie. What concerns me is that this the counting of the votes has so obviously been skewed, as we just saw again the other day when you made mention of the difference in the vote being exactly what it took for them not to do a recount. And so it seems to me that as long as the Republicans are controlling the voting, not the voting, but the counting of the votes, we'll never change anything. So how do you address that, Bernie?
Well, I am as pessimistic about that as some people are.
You're not as pessimistic.
No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we know that this is an issue you and I have discussed many, many times. It is scary and it is unacceptable that we have touchscreen balloting without a paper trail so that we can do a recount. That is unacceptable, and I hope that state by state by state, that will be changed. On the other hand, I think sometimes when we keep saying, what can we do, that absolves us from doing the hard political work that must be done.
So we have to win by such overwhelming majorities that they can't steal the elections.
And we have to elect secretaries of state, local public officials who are going to make sure that every vote is counted accurately.
There you go. Okay. Susan, thanks for that call from Santa Cruz. Much appreciated. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Brunch with Bernie. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman with you 5 minutes before the hour. Bernie, we've got a lot of calls here. Let's try and get through them real quick, and I'm going to ask the callers to try and just one-sentence question very quickly if possible so we can get through a couple of them. Dave in Humboldt County, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, I am completely convinced, like Tom, that these voting machines is what's brought us so many of these dangerous, unethical creeps in high office. And we got two or three people, I guess, after the delay, blocking Conyers and Holt's efforts to make these machines verifiable. Is there any way you can get around that? Can two or three people steal the democracy?
I'm on board that legislation, and it's very high on my priority list and on many members' priorities. We're fighting hard, but like many other issues, the Republican leadership can prevent that from coming up for a vote.
Okay.
But take it at the state level as well.
Okay. Tony in Maryland on the line. Hey, Tony.
Hi. My question is there any bill or any law that has been passed through Congress, through the whole Congress, that actually financially benefits the people of the United States?
Has there ever been legislation that has been passed that does that?
No, within the last 4.5 years.
I won't say never. There maybe have been some things out there, but by and large, the overwhelming pieces of legislation that have been passed benefit the very wealthy.
So, Tony, I think, is referring to a contest I've been running for a year and a half. I asked Tom Tancredo, name one piece of legislation the Republicans have proposed and Bush has signed into law that benefits us rather than corporations. And so far, nobody has won.
Yep. Norman in
Norman in Montgomery, Alabama. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes, hi, Congressman Sanders. Thank you for being on. Listen, I just wanted to say that I feel that the problem that we've got in government is systemic corruption, and it flows throughout our entire federal and state governments. There's plenty of evidence out there that Bush and his administration were aware of and may have been complicit in the 9/11 attacks on our country. That the reason for going to Afghanistan really didn't have anything to do with Osama bin Laden, and same for Iraq. How do we really resolve the problems
I just don't agree with that basic premise. And one of the problems that we have is getting a little bit paranoid.
But Norman's bigger question of how do we deal with corruption is a good one.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we need a grassroots political revolution where people are prepared to get involved in the political process and develop an agenda, progressive agenda, that represents the needs of the middle class rather than large corporations and wealthy individuals.
So whether there's a conspiracy behind 9/11 or not, whether the voting machines or not, if we get enough people energized.
Yeah. But this conspiracy theory, the result of that is people put their hands up in the air and say, we can't do anything, and I don't accept it. That's wrong, and that's why conspiracy theory is not a great idea.
Okay, I salute you. Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us.
Again, good to be with you, Tom.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy Friday. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, our website. I'm going to tell you about Goosellini, our goose, and some geese piece. And what might that have to do with Robert Novak? We got a lot to talk about here. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to have a discussion with somebody from the Ayn Rand Institute about the wonders of corporations and what should we do about them. First, Seth in Pittsburgh is on the line. Hey, Seth, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I tried to call last week, and then I ended up getting, because in the lunch hour, it's tough for me to get through and all that.
Sure.
But if he's still listening, I wanted to tell Bernie Sanders, you know, I'm a huge, huge fan, you know what I mean?
I'll pass it along to him. I suspect he's off to work. But
you know, I'm a fan of your show, too. I'm glad that we have this show in Pittsburgh now. You know?
Thank you.
I drive all day, and then I'm able to listen to it. What I wanted to ask him was, I'm asking you, you know, most corporations are publicly shared. And, you know, and then, you know, a prudent shareholder, you know, would look at the, you know, what the company's doing and all that. And I don't understand how, you know, we've gotten to a point where we can see that, you know, a CEO is making 500 times what an employee makes and all the rest. And you know, the one guy was talking about Walmart there. I mean, it was always my understanding that the reason that a pair of Nike shoes cost $80 is because of advertising and upper management salaries. You know, I don't really see how, you know, if we started making things here again and we had a little bit more, you know, fiscal responsibility in the upper end and in the advertising and that, I think we could make them, you know, and be competitive with anybody.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, and to use the example of Walmart, Seth, and I appreciate your call, by the way. Thank you for your kind words. To use the example of Nike, the quote-unquote brilliance of Phil Knight, who lives just down the road from me here, by the way, the quote-unquote brilliance of him was that what he did was he said, okay, people are making shoes in the United States. This is back 20 years ago. People are making shoes in the United States. I can make them in Malaysia or in Vietnam or in China or whatever for, you know, a fraction of that cost, for a tenth of that cost, and I can take that extra money and put it into marketing and build a brand. And Nike intentionally has never manufactured shoes. They don't make shoes. They buy them from subcontractors. Nike is a marketing company. And that became a model that was possible because of free trade legislation that had been pushed through. The initial pressure came from Reagan during the Reagan administration, then George Herbert Walker Bush getting fast-track authority for bilateral and multilateral negotiations, and then Bill Clinton signing NAFTA and GATT. And all of that is what, you know, turned Knight into a multi-billionaire, one of the richest people in the country. And it's, you know, very straightforward. Ship your jobs offshore. We've traditionally had laws and rules in the United States, trade rules, that said, can't do that, sorry. Or you can do that, but it's going to cost you. If it costs a dollar worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in the United States, and you can make that same pair of shoes in China for 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine, you can do that. I mean, you can't pass a law that prohibits people from engaging in commerce, but what you can say is that if you import those shoes into the United States, once they pass the border into the United States, there's a 90-cent tax on them. So it's going to cost, you know, 10 cents of labor plus 90 cents in tax, or $1 in terms of the labor cost to make them in China, or it's going to cost a dollar to make them in North Carolina. Your choice. You can make them wherever you want. And then most reasonable business people would say, well, you know, the shipping from North Carolina is cheaper than the shipping from China, so I'll take North Carolina. And that's how we kept jobs in the United States. We had tariff laws. First tariff was passed in 1787. And Tench Cox was the guy who pushed for it. He was the founder of the first chamber of commerce in America. He was not a legislator. He was arguably the first lobbyist, a friend of George Washington's, a guy who during the American Revolution actually thought the revolution was a bad idea because it would be bad for business. After the revolution, he embraced it, became an American patriot, was a friend of many of the founders of this country, many of the framers of the Constitution, and became a strong advocate for tariff legislation that would protect domestic industries in the United States. We passed those laws, and over the next 200 100 years built America into one of the mightiest industrial powerhouses in the world. Ronald Reagan started deconstructing that because the big multinational corporations wanted to be able to make money and say, you know, we don't care what happens to the American worker. That's not our bottom line. Our bottom line is how much money goes to our CEOs and our stockholders. And in fact, George Bush, in his last so-called tax cut of all these tax cuts that he passed, his last tax cut was to reduce the amount of taxes that you pay if the way you earn your living is sitting around your pool, sitting on your butt around the pool, waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. That is the checks that corporations send out to their stockholders every quarter or every year. They take their profit and they take a portion of their profit and divide it up among their stockholders based on how much stock each person has. And you get a check in the mail if you own stocks. If you own many, you know, most stocks, most publicly traded stocks, issue dividends, or many of them anyway. And you get this check in the mail for the dividend. And the last tax cut was to say, if you earn your living by simply receiving dividend checks, you only have to pay 15% maximum income tax, period. And you pay no Social Security tax at all. Only working people have to pay that. And working people have to pay income taxes up into the 30s%. But, you know, and so this is absolutely consistent with the so-called Republican, so-called conservative way of looking at the world, of thinking of it, which is, you know, working people, screw the working people. This is all about CEOs and inherited wealth. And that's the bottom line. And if you can figure out how to game the system and get into it. Logan in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind today?
Hi. By the way, I am a conservative. I would consider myself a pro-labor conservative.
There's no such thing, Logan.
Excuse me?
There's no such thing. The definition.
Well, I happen to be one. I just invented that category.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll acknowledge it as the Logan conservative category. But if you look at, you know, classic conservatism, you know, read William F. Buckley, read Russell Kirk, The Conservative Mind, the 1953 book that defined the modern conservative movement, and or go back to Sir Edmund Burke back in, you know, the 1780s. Very clear that the conservatives historically are in favor of a hierarchical, authoritarian, essentially as aristocratic form of government. And the big change between British conservatives and American conservatives in the 1700s was that British conservatives always wanted power to be in the hands of the crown, and American conservatives said, no, we should be a meritocracy. If somebody's smart enough, they should become part of the ruling elite. But the conservatives have always been about a ruling elite. Liberals have always been about power to the people.
Well, I think there's
Look it up in the dictionary.
In any situation, I think there's going to be, you know, a division in classes. I think that's just kind of a normal evolving process in societies. But my question was about how I do agree with these that these free trade agreements are against working people. But at the same token, and I also agree that, you know, the conservatives are in the dark about that. But on the flip side of the coin, I think that the left is kind of in the dark about illegal immigration and what it's also kind of part of I think it's kind of an anti-labor type of it also is anti-labor.
Here's my position on illegal immigration, Logan, and you tell me, because I don't know that there is a position on the left, and from what I can...
Listen to John Sweeney, listen to Howard Dean.
Yeah, I have, actually, and it seems to me that they're saying the same thing. My position on illegal immigration is that it's illegal. People who are in this country illegally should be removed from this country. And the thing that most people are missing, though, is why are there illegal immigrants in the United States? And it's not what the conservatives and some liberals would tell you. It's not that this is a wonderful country and they want to come and live here. Certainly that's true. But that's the reason why people legally emigrate to the United States. The reason why people illegally emigrate to the United States is because they believe they can find work. And it used to be 20, 30 years ago, our border with Mexico was much more open than it is today. There were no fences. You could swim across the Rio Grande River. It was no big deal. Why weren't people flooding into the United States 30 years ago, 40 years ago, like they are now? The reason is very simple. 30, 40 years ago, we had a strong labor movement in the United States. And to get the really good middle class jobs, to get a job as a carpenter, for example, you had to join the Carpenters Union. The Carpenters Union was the first line of defense. They made sure that their members were actually American citizens. Nowadays, now that you've got big contractors, big corporations hiring the carpenters directly, there's no union involved, and the wages have dropped from, you know, the $16, $18 an hour that they were 30 years ago down into the $5, $6, $7 an hour range, there's a, they're hiring illegal immigrants. And so the problem is not, you know, we shouldn't be blaming the immigrants. We should simply be deporting them, number one. We shouldn't be blaming the laws and, you know, saying we need a stronger border because, frankly, it's not going to be possible. What we need to do is we need to rebuild the labor infrastructure in the United States because that's the first line of defense against illegal immigration.
Well, I think we can have a strong border. I mean, look at Mexico. They have a strong border against Guatemala right now, and there it is enforced rather well. And I think we can do the same thing. I know we got a longer stretch of border. But
let's say, Logan, that we put up an absolutely impenetrable, laser-operated, you get fried if you get within 100 feet of a wall that went, and Mexico's border with Guatemala, by the way, is tiny. Tiny, because, you know, Mexico gets narrower and narrower as you go south. But let's say that we put up a huge wall there in the south. What are you going to do about the 10 to 12, some would say even as many as 20 million illegal Mexican immigrants in the United and South American immigrants in the United States right now?
Well, I think it's not going to be an overnight thing. I think it's going to take a little time. I think you got to bump. I think what I'd do is I'd have nonviolent felons kind of work those jobs or you know, people...
Work what jobs?
The jobs that the illegals are doing right now.
Why not simply start paying decent wages and involve organized labor in the process?
I agree. That's another thing.
I mean, I had a guy in this program who called in from... He owned a winery in California. And he says, I've got to hire illegal labor because otherwise I can't make cheap wine. And I said, okay, how much are you paying your illegals? And he said, we're paying them around $6 an hour. And I said, and what percentage of the cost of your wine is that? And he said, oh, it's probably about 10%, 12% of the cost of the wine, you know, at the retail. And I said, okay, so if you were paying $12 an hour... And you had, you know, Native Americans, or not Native American, American citizens who were, you know, and the farm workers union involved. How much would that, doubling the cost of your labor, how much would that increase the cost of your wine in the store? And he said, oh, a $7 bottle of wine might be $7.50. You know, a $20 bottle of wine might be $21. And I said, now, if that happened to everybody who was making wine and everybody's cost went up and so all the wine went up by a dollar or so, you think anybody's going to stop buying wine? He said, probably not. And I said, then what's wrong with that? And he's like, oh, gee, that makes sense.
Yeah,
that's what we need to do.
You and I are in agreement there.
And I would say most liberals are.
Yeah.
See, this is the thing. The conservatives, you're saying you're conservative because you've been listening to these cons who are not conservatives, folks like Rush Limbaugh. They're reactionaries.
A lot of the cons I listen to, actually, well, not all of them, but some of them are actually, you know, for the George Bush pseudo-amnesty program.
Yeah, well, you know, and see, that's the thing. I mean, Bush is the one who wants to talk about amnesty because it'll help the big corporations. If you want to understand what liberals are thinking, ask a liberal. Don't ask the conservative talk show host because they don't know. And what they're going to do is they're going to lie to you about what liberals and progressives in the United States are thinking and get you thinking that that's what it's all about. And it ain't. It's not true. I mean, you know, liberals and progressives in the United States love this country as much as anybody. And believe that, you know, America should be for America. And Mexico should be for Mexico. I mean, we should, you know, if Mexico has a problem, we should be helping them out to fix their problems, as it were, but not saying, hey, send all your people up here and take our jobs. It doesn't work. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Forces of the world unite. Let us save the day.
Yes, the bosses need to unite.
Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay.
How dare those workers want us to cut our pay?
500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard and we too sometimes need to paint our homes.
Yes, it's just
the pressures are incredible and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico.
At that rate, pretty soon there'll be no place for us to go.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894 for our telephone number. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, some left-wing media we got, the so-called left-wing part of the infamous Robert Novak debate, James Carville. I noticed, you know, he wasn't getting up there talking about CAFTA.
No,
I was just
Carville's part of the DLC problem, frankly, in my mind.
Yeah, and well, that's a side issue. I shouldn't even gone into that. Thing is, some left-wing media we got, you look around the cable news networks and the new evening news last night and all that, who's the only one covering the Robert Novak incident? Otherwise you'd have thought it never happened yesterday. The only one covering it is Jon Stewart.
Yeah, there you go. You're absolutely right, Joe. It's and you know, Comedy Central is the only group out there that's actually doing good news these days. Thanks for the call, Joe. I appreciate it. Greg Gorman, with the Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Greg, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, Tom, it's a lovely Friday. We're all ready to go home, and there's not much going on except a lot of White House back scratching.
Back scratching?
Yes. I can tell you that the White House is putting out these reports that they are happy to be sending support to two of the House of Representatives, or the two, I should say, two Republicans in the House of Representatives who switched their vote at the last minute and supported CAFTA, and they are getting support from the White House through Rob Portman and Carlos Gutierrez. It's all about the midterm elections that are coming up next year, and the White House is happy to say thank you for helping us. We passed CAFTA, and they're happy to do that. Also, President Bush is going to be thanking Secretary of the House Dennis Hastert by going to his home district in Illinois to sign the $286 billion highway bill next week.
Right.
Now, Scott McClellan told us that earlier this week, or I guess it was this week, might have been last week, that the president will not just be on vacation. He'll be doing things, and one of the things he'll be doing is signing this big highway bill, and so he's going to be going to Illinois, and there'll be lots of pomp and circumstance, and Dennis Hastert will get a big pat on the back from the president.
Yeah. And ironically, the transportation bill is probably the only one that came out that is actually going to provide a significant financial stimulus. It's actually going to help the economy, even with all the pork in it, because what it does is it creates local jobs across the United States, which puts money into workers' pockets, which allows them then to spend that money, which creates demand. So,
well, that's exactly right. And that actually leads me into my next point, which even though it's summer and Washington is dead, the White House is happy to put out numbers to make sure that we all know that the job growth is up and unemployment is down or steady, and people are now earning more money, according to the Department of Labor, 16 cents to be exact. And so the White House, like you just mentioned, they're actually trying to say, look, everything we're doing, everything we've done, you know, all these bills we're passing, and CAFTA will bring jobs, and the energy bill will do this, and the transportation bill will do this. See, it's really working.
Yeah, and the reality is, Greg, if you strip the war part of out of that, take out those $150,000 a year jobs of, you know, that Halliburton has for people who want to go over to Iraq and get shot at, if you take out the war component of this economy, we are in the tank. We are absolutely in the tank. And you say, oh, there's all these middle-class people, all these middle-class homes, all these cars driving on the highways. They're all mortgaged to their eyeballs and scared to death. And Bush is just making things worse. Greg Gorman, thank you. Thank you for that report, Greg. Good to hear from you. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. Are corporations persons? Should corporations have rights? Are corporations, should corporations have the same protections under the Constitution as individual human beings? How does it all work? How should it all work? Dr. Robert Garmong is with us. He's a PhD in philosophy. He's a writer for the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine, California, AYNRAND.org. That institute promotes the philosophy of Ayn Rand, author of Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead, a philosophy that is generally called objectivism, that I would say gave birth to the libertarians in the United States, who in turn strongly influenced the modern conservative movement in the United States. I know you guys don't take credit for all that, but I think it's pretty obvious. Robert, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
And would you, by the way, would you dispute your influence?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think Ayn Rand has had a tremendous influence. Certainly, Ayn Rand herself would not have agreed with much that's been done in her name, but I think I claim with pride to have had influence, that she has had influence.
Yeah, and certainly, like the Cato organization and whatnot. In any case, let's talk about corporations. You were on our program a few weeks ago. We were talking about privatizing the space program, and you suggested, and I think correctly, that there's really a larger issue here. And that is the risk versus benefits, to quote you, of corporate control of any industry, not just space. What's your take on this?
Well, my view is that the corporation per se has been much maligned in today's world, and I think that that's a mistake on our part. The corporation per se, not to say that corporations can't commit fraudulent actions and so on, but the corporation per se is the engine of economic growth and prosperity, and I think that we do a tremendous disservice to our benefactors and to our own economic progress by attacking and maligning them.
You know, in 1886, in the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, the fellow who was arguing on behalf of Santa Clara County, Delmas Dolphin, said that a corporation is a legal fiction. It is an artifice of the law. And the Supreme Court justice at that time, Morrison Remick Waite, agreed with that point. And the argument was, should a corporation be considered an artificial person, or should it have rights of a natural person? And the court ultimately ruled that corporations should not have rights as natural persons, although the clerk of the court wrote into the decision that they would have those rights, and thus we're stuck with that now. But Delmas was saying, no, I'm sorry, a corporation is not the people in it. A corporation is simply a piece of paper that the state issues that gives people the authority to organize their money together in a way that they can conduct business. I mean, how is that responsible for our economic engine? We didn't really even have in the United States, we had fewer than 2,000 corporations in the United States at the time of the Civil War. And the United States was no small, it was no piker in 1860. Isn't it people who build the economy of the United States? Isn't it free enterprise?
It is the case that corporations have frequently been regarded as so-called legal fictions, but if that's the case, then really any contract is a legal fiction.
That's right.
Any contract is.
Yeah, I'm not saying that in a derogatory sense. I'm simply saying that's what's so. It's an abstraction. A corporation is an abstraction.
That certainly is the case, but like any abstraction, it is an engine of integration. A corporation allows us to integrate our economic activities in ways that you couldn't possibly have individual contracts with everyone to create something like IBM. You couldn't have that sort of thing if every single individual had to negotiate with every other individual within that entity.
But it only works. IBM does. They have contracts with all of their employees, they have contracts with all of their vendors, and they have contracts with all of their suppliers. I've done business with IBM. I can tell you that from firsthand experience.
They contract as an entity, however. When you do business with IBM, you don't have to sign a separate contract with everybody in IBM.
Oh, sure, sure, but I'm not...
You're going to work
with. I'm not suggesting that there shouldn't be corporations. Perhaps you've misunderstood me. I'm not suggesting that the corporate form shouldn't exist. I think the corporate form is just fine. My problem is when a corporation, a legal abstraction, tries to claim that the rights that the founders fought and died for, the right of, for example, free speech, the right, for example, of privacy that were granted to human beings, that those rights should also be granted to corporations. I think the human beings within the corporations should have those rights, but I think it's wrong when Dow Chemical argues, as they did before the Supreme Court, that they have the Fourth Amendment right of privacy and therefore can conceal actual crimes from we the people. However, on the other hand, they turn right around and they say, but if you work for Dow Chemical, the minute that you walk on the property of that company, you have surrendered your right to privacy because that's private property, and they can watch you, they can monitor your bodily fluids, they can monitor your email, they can observe you by camera. If you lose your right of free speech, if you speak out in particular ways, they can fire you. That humans no longer have those rights, but the corporation maintains its right of privacy 24/7. I think that's wrong.
But a corporation is no different from any other person under the law. If you hire me and bring me into your house, let's say, to do work on your house, you have rights over what I do on your property, just as a corporation has rights over what you do on their property. And if you don't like it, you don't have to work for them. And there's a fundamental equivocation here between the power of the government, which is limited by things like First Amendment rights and so on, and the power of the corporation. A corporation, like any other legal person, has only the power of a positive, only the power to offer you incentives. They will hire you and pay you more than their competitors will pay you. They will offer you a product. If you don't like it, as people didn't like IBM's product in the early 90s, the corporation can and will fail. IBM came very close to failing. They can succeed,
Robert,
only
you keep
by
saying,
offering you a positive.
You keep saying
as opposed
a corporation.
To the government.
No, hang on just a second here. You keep saying a corporation just like any other person. To the best of my knowledge, if a corporation tried to apply for a marriage license, they'd be laughed out of the Justice of the Peace's office, don't you think?
Of course, it would be meaningless.
Okay, and if a corporation tried to get health insurance, it wouldn't make any sense, would it?
Because a corporation doesn't have health.
Because a corporation doesn't fear death. A corporation doesn't fear death. If a corporation doesn't fear death, it doesn't need to eat, it doesn't need to breathe fresh air, it doesn't need fresh water to drink, and if it can't marry, then why should a corporation have constitutional protections guaranteed to these fragile biological entities that need all these things called human beings?
We have rights that are determined by our nature. We have a right, for instance, to life. We have a right to liberty. We have a right to property. Now, of course, some of those rights don't have any particular meaning when applied to an abstraction like a corporation, but others do. A corporation can speak. A corporation
How?
Can die by...
Wait a second. How can a corporation speak?
By issuing a press release, by having spokespersons, they have them, they speak all the time. Corporations can perform certain functions the same as you and I. And
so you're suggesting that a corporation, which is an artifice of law rather than a biological creature, because they can speak by virtue of, even though they don't have a mouth, and they can't breathe, they can't speak the way that you and I speak. So you're describing written language as a form of speech. That if a corporation can speak, you think that they should have, as Nike argued before the Supreme Court last year, they should have the right of free speech that you and I have of lying to people. That if I say to my wife, hey, that, you know, you look great in that dress, and I don't think so, that's a lie. It's not a crime. In fact, if I say to pretty much anybody anything that's a lie, it's not a crime unless it's a police officer or I'm under oath. And you think that a corporation should have that same right, that they can lie to us?
Well, you don't have the right to lie under certain circumstances any more than a corporation.
That's
does.
What I just suggested. But should Nike have the right when they said, oh, we were cleaning up our sweatshop labor practices? Here's the case. I mean, this is a real case. Nike had hired a PR firm, and they were around the country sending letters to the editor as if it was local folks saying, oh, I'm so glad to hear that Nike's cleaned up their sweatshop labor practices. A guy named Robert Caskey down in California discovered that Nike's PR firm was doing this, and that, in fact, they hadn't cleaned up their sweatshop labor practices. He sued them under the consumer protection laws, the consumer fraud laws of the state of California, and said, you can't say that. Nike's defense was not, oh, we actually did clean up our sweatshop labor practices. Nike's defense was, we didn't clean up our actually, they didn't even address that. Their defense was, we're a person, and the First Amendment says persons shall have the right of free speech. Because we're a person, we have the same right of free speech everybody else does, and therefore we have the right to lie. Now, you're telling me that's okay.
It is illegal and ought to be illegal to the extent that it constitutes actual fraud. If, for instance, they're making a fraudulent claim about a product, that is prosecutable because you may be harmed by the purchase of a product. But I do not believe that we should have a double standard where the corporation itself is legally shackled and legally prevented from aggressively self-defending.
But a corporation has so much more capability than a human being. A corporation can live forever. It can aggregate wealth forever. It never faces an inheritance tax or probate. It has the ability to change its citizenship in an afternoon. Corporations are so much more powerful than individual humans. By giving them equal rights with humans, you're giving that club that the founders in the first 10 amendments of the Constitution and later the 13th, 14th, and 15th, that the founders gave to we fragile humans so we could beat back government should it ever become oppressive. You're handing that same club to corporations, and they beat back government in a way that then allows the corporations to become the oppressors.
Corporations have exactly one power, and that is the power to provide individual people with incentives, positives. They cannot coerce anyone. They do not have the power of the gun. They do not have the power of a negative. They have the power exclusively of a positive. They can offer you a product. They can offer you a paycheck. That is their only power. And so their rights are directly derived from your right to deal with them or not to deal with them.
Well, that's not true, Robert. Corporation has the power to ruin you if they want to. I mean, look at, you know, repossessing companies, credit companies, companies that engage in fraud. Tell that to the people who worked for Enron who thought that their pensions were protected.
Okay, now this is bringing up a very important point, and
tell that to the people who live downstream from the factories that George Bush right now is saying, oh, we should just let corporations trade their pollution credits.
Let me clarify my position, because I think this is a very important clarification. What I'm advocating is not anarchy. I'm not advocating that corporations should be exempt from the law, but I think that. The government exists to protect individual rights. And if a corporation commits fraud, as Enron did, then I believe they should be prosecuted, and the individuals who were individually responsible for that fraud should be prosecuted to the fullest.
Robert, do you think that if a person commits murder, multiple murders, a serial killer commits multiple murders against people and does it intentionally and knowingly, that that person should be put to death?
I have no personal opinion about the death penalty,
but you don't have a problem with it.
I do not have a moral problem with it.
Okay, then why is it that why is it that you have corporations like General Electric that have been convicted of multiple felonies, and not specifically General Electric? I don't know if they've been convicted of multiple felonies that involve the death of people, but I know that there are many corporations out there that have been indicted and convicted for felonies that involve the death of people. The most recent example was a corporation out of the Midwest that knew that they had a salmonella problem and covered it up for a while, and over 100 people died. Why is that corporation not given the death penalty?
That I don't know the particular circumstances. I don't know the particular situation, but I do believe that corporations should be held under the law, just the same as you and I. And
I mean, when Ford Motor Company or General Motors, with their side-saddled gas tanks on their trucks, they decided that they would save, you know, $3 a piece on the trucks because they figured the average lawsuit from people who died in these horrific car crashes would be $250,000, and they calculated how many thousands of people would die and times $250,000 and how much that would cost versus $2.50 a car, and came up with a risk-benefit equation and said, you know, what the heck, we'll let a few thousand people die because it's going to save us some money. You think that's just fine?
You're attacking me for you're really attacking a straw man here. This is not what I'm defending. What I'm defending is the right of a corporation to operate under the law and to be considered a person under the law. That means also the responsibilities of a person. And so if it's true that a corporation knowingly and fraudulently causes death, then that corporation can be prosecuted just the same way that you or I do. And there are different issues of risk involved. Obviously, anybody who buys a car is accepting a certain risk.
Well, Robert, tobacco is a product that kills you when used as directed. Do you think the tobacco company should be put out of business?
No, absolutely not, because we all know the risk. Anyone who's ever inhaled cigarette smoke and had his entire body rebel against it.
For 50 years, the tobacco companies hid those risks. In fact, I remember as a child watching Ronald Reagan on television dressed like a doctor saying, if you have a sore throat, smoke Chesterfields. They were lying to us. They knew at that time that that product would kill us. In fact, it's killing my father right now.
You see, again, you're criticizing me for a position I do not hold. To the extent that corporations cover something up, they should be prosecuted. However, you have to also look at the flip side and ask, why is it that the corporations feel it so absolutely necessary to hide risks? And I think we have this anti-corporate mentality in America today that says corporations are inherently and automatically guilty for everything.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that they hid the risk by virtue of the use of the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, and that's inappropriate. They shouldn't apply to corporations. Robert, we'll come back from the break. We've got some callers who want to ask you questions. We'll try and get through them very quickly. We're talking with Robert Garmon. Garmon, how do you pronounce it, Robert?
Garmon
of the Ayn Rand Foundation, AYNRAND.org. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It ain't no use to sit and wonder why they.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here. We're talking with Robert Garmon of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Robert, let's take a few calls here. Is that all right with you?
Great.
Okay, Nick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hi. On the issue of corporations counting as people here, I don't like the idea because it inherently gives corporations and certain people twice double the advantage when it comes time to voting and influencing political decisions and political policy. These are people that are at work, they're working for IBM or whatever XYZ corporation, and they're using their power as a corporation, saying that they're people, okay, they're using their influence to, distort our process or whatever, for better or for worse. But then they leave that corporation, they go home, and they can vote. Do you see what I'm saying? So, it's kind of a... It's not inherently, it doesn't seem right either. You know, you have the power of vote and influence for our process. I believe it should be either one way or the other. One vote. One man, one vote.
Thank you, Nick. This is what Teddy Roosevelt said in 1907 when he passed the law that corporations couldn't give money to politicians. Robert?
Well, I think that if you take the logic of this sort of argument, you would have to say that no organization should be able to take a position politically. No labor union, no nonprofit. Nobody should have the ability to do so. We don't live in a world in which it's a plebiscite and everyone gets together and without the opportunity to join together and argue and debate.
But the reality is that labor unions are restricted from political activity right now.
Okay. What about the New York Times? Do they have the right to have an op-ed page or to have an editorial page?
They certainly assert that, yeah.
If you take the logic of this position, then you would have to shut down any independent press organization from taking a position on politics. I don't think you should. I think we live in a world in which we have the right to join together.
So you think that if a corporation wants to hand $5 million to somebody to run in a local race and overwhelm their opponent because that corporation wants that local politician to hand to them 50 acres in the center of town, that that's just fine?
I think they should have the right opposition, and I think we have the right to freedom of association in this country. It's a First Amendment right.
Okay, Robert, we'll leave you with the last word on that. Robert Garmon of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
I do appreciate it. It is the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no RNC pass required. We won't haul you out if you've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. Yes, the real free speech on the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back after the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. Yeah, an interesting discussion in the last hour about corporations and the nature of corporations. In the previous hour, we talked, actually, I guess it was in the beginning of the last hour, I talked briefly about illegal immigration. I want to return to that topic as well. It's one that I think that progressives don't talk about enough, and that really we need to lay at the feet of corporate exploitation of Americans and the handmaidens of them, the conservatives. First, let's take a few calls on the topics. Well, on the topics of the day, it's Friday, actually, anything you want to talk about. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
What's going on? First of all, I wanted to address, like, the issue of voting. According to my information, people can refuse to use the touchscreen voting. They, you know, have to make it, you know, explicit that they want a record of their voting and that they have a actual paper ballot.
Right, and you just ask for the what usually are absentee ballots.
Right, yeah. And the voting precinct has to provide one. They cannot refuse you one. So it is up actually to the voter whether or not they use that touch screen device.
I believe
they do,
Jason,
not have to use it.
I believe, Jason, those laws vary from state to state, although I don't know of any states that don't allow people to ask for absentee ballots. But the federal constitution has nothing basically in it about voting. So in almost all cases, the decisions about who can vote, how they can vote, and under what circumstances they can vote and what they can vote on are all made at the state level. In fact, that was, yeah, I mean, that was the whole basis of the federal government deciding to interfere with that, with the Voting Rights Act, which is up for renewal, by the way, and it's a really critical and important thing that we do so. The opposition to the Voting Rights Act back in the 1960s was that the federal government had never messed in this before, except to say that there were certain classes of people who could not be denied the vote. Women in the 1920s, in fact, wasn't it 1920 itself, that year, I think, that women got the vote. And African Americans with the 13th Amendment in 66 or 67. But beyond that, you know, states really had the opportunity to run that stuff themselves. But you make a good point.
Yeah, but and so much for smaller government under Republicans.
Yeah.
Again.
Well, you know, they only believe in smaller government when it has to do with government protecting you and me. If it's government protecting big corporations, they're all in favor of big government.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the second point is the deal with corporations. You know, it just seems kind of crazy that a corporation can be considered a person under law because, you know, they don't have to suffer the same indictments or adhere to the same rules as people do. Say in the case of when corporations, through their negligence, kill large numbers of people, like what happened in Bhopal, India, you know, what's happening now with air pollution, how they're influencing legislation so that they can continue to pollute. So the global warming keeps escalating, and corporations, with their influence, are demanding from their politicians that they give donations to, on the one hand, and then the corporate bigwigs, they go off and they vote Republican on the second hand, like one of the callers previously mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, all of these things figure into corporations having extraordinarily more power, extraordinarily more freedoms than the average human being.
And this is the reason, you're absolutely right, Jason, and this is the reason why historically we have chosen to limit the power of corporations. We said, okay, you guys can get together and form the corporate form. You can get together and form a corporation. You can, in other words, capital can form a union, right? It can, you know, like labor can form unions, capital can form a union. You can organize for the purposes of increasing your wealth. But if you're going to do that, there are certain rules to the game of business that you're playing. And those rules of the game of the business, you know, know, historically have been, corporations can't own other corporations, corporations can't monopolize markets, corporations can't act in a way that harms the public good. In fact, corporations must behave in a way that at some level, somehow, even if it's just providing employment, benefits the public good. Corporations used to be, in the United States, corporations couldn't live forever, every 30 to 40 years, depending on the state. Some states it was even 20 years. Corporations had to be dissolved, their stock distributed, and they had to start over again. And so that they had a lifespan, just like human beings do. And all of that changed in the late 1800s, in part because of the Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, and in part because of the corruption largely by John Rockefeller. He began this whole thing of the charter mongering era, where he was pitting states against each other after Ohio threw him out, said what he was doing was criminal with the Standard Oil Trust of Ohio. He said, okay, what state will change their laws so what I'm doing is not criminal in their state? And New Jersey said, we will, and New York said, we will, and Delaware said, we will, and Connecticut said, we will, and these northeastern states started this bidding war. New Jersey ended up with Rockefeller, but Delaware actually ended up with the laxest rules, which is why half of the Fortune 500 companies are registered in Delaware. Even though it's a little tiny state, most of them, you know, they just have a post office box there. It's Delaware is like the Grand Caymans of the country. So right. Good point. Jason, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
And for
making that
point.
You're welcome. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Michelle in Long Beach, California on the line. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. Hey, obviously you've talked about the National Labor Relations allowing employers to ban off-duty fraternizing among coworkers.
You know, I've got that on my list, and 2 days in a row I've intended to get to it, and I just got buried. That's a big deal.
I had to call you on that one.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It is a big deal, and I'm so glad you brought that up. The National Labor Relations Board, which is supposed to be defending the interests of labor, that's why it was created back in 1937, I think it was created, or was it in 1935 as part of the Wagner Act? And the NLRB is supposed to protect labor, and they just ruled that it's illegal for employees to fraternize off hours. Now, what they were suggesting in this ruling was that by fraternization, they meant dating. But the way it's been worded, it's so broadly worded that it could make union organizing illegal, or it could make, Louise and I going out for a drink tonight illegal.
Exactly.
We work together, and she's my wife. I wonder if that's a problem.
Yeah, I was... You know, I just looked up the word fraternize, you know, and it says associate in a brotherly manner.
Right.
Be friendly terms.
As in fraternity.
I mean, right, exactly. And, you know, that is the whole issue that, you know, legally lawyers can bring up and throw that word out there and say, hey, it could mean this, this, or this. I mean, so much legislation, so many things that have been happening are on these broad wordings, you know, and can encompass so much. I mean, think about what I wanted to say to Robert was, you know, then why isn't it that we have a regulation that, allows the citizens to ban any off-duty fraternizing, in a sense, of these corporations with public officials?
Yeah, or with each other.
Exactly.
Corporations fraternizing with each other is called deal making.
Yeah, like with the Bush family, with his brother and his cousin.
Yeah.
You know that.
Well, that's called cronyism.
Yeah, you see what it's just like. It was so absurd to hear from him saying, "Oh, they should have equal rights." Well, as well as we have equal rights, and it's like, no, there's no comparison legally wise. I mean, I wonder how much money we spend in tax paying to support these judicial situations with a corporation coming in and suing for this or suing for that. You know?
During the Eisenhower administration and during the Kennedy administration, during that period of time, the 1950s and the 1960s, corporations paid about half of the taxes in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And about half the load. And most people, the best guess is that corporations use about half, maybe even more actually, of the total of the commons. Depends on how you define use. For example, our school systems. Are our school systems being used by you and I, people who have, by parents and kids and people who are educated in our public school systems? Or are our school systems being used by corporations because they provide an educated workforce? You could argue both. Both are actually true. And so you could say, okay, they're getting, it's a 50-50 thing. Corporations, are they using our roads even though they don't necessarily drive on them, a corporation that doesn't, because their workforce can use the roads to get to work? Okay, they are. Corporations using our water, using our fresh air, using our communications infrastructure, big time. Corporations using our court system to enforce contracts, corporations using our monetary system, our Treasury Department, our Federal Reserve, all this stuff to, you know, so that they can conduct business. Now we find that corporations, instead of paying half the load of the commons that they use along with us, they're down to paying, it depends on the state, you know, at the federal level it's around 14-15%, and some states here in Oregon, for example, it's in the 5% range.
Yeah.
And this is a sea change since the 1950s. People wonder why their taxes are so high and why they're having such a hard time getting by. It's not because, you know, liberals have raised their taxes. It's because conservatives have slashed taxes on corporations, and we're paying the rest of the load. And that's why the commons is falling apart as well, because there's just not enough there, you know, to support it. And what do the corporations do? For example, you had Toyota, I believe it was, one of the Japanese automakers, I'm pretty sure it was Toyota, was looking at building an auto factory here in the United States or in North America. And they looked around the United States, and they've been negotiating with Alabama. Alabama was going to offer them $500 million, as I recall, in tax incentives and rebates and all kinds of stuff to, you know, please bring some jobs to Alabama. And they decided to go to Canada. Why did they decide to go to Canada? Because Canada had, they said, a better educated workforce. Yeah. In other words, our failure to invest in the infrastructure that is used by corporations is a direct result of the fact that conservatives have been saying, oh, corporations shouldn't have to pay their fair share for those commons that they use. And it's nuts, and it's harming the United States, and therefore we don't get those jobs. And you know, it's destroying the middle class in the United States. It's like it's the Manchurian Candidate thing. Michelle, thank you for the call.
Thank you,
appreciate
Tom.
Your kind words. It's like the Manchurian Candidate thing. If you know the movie The Manchurian Candidate posited that there was this guy who was an agent of the communist Soviets, right, who was snuck into the U.S. Political system and eventually became president, and his job was to destroy the United States. Now just imagine for a moment. If you were the Manchurian Candidate, if your job was to destroy the United States and you were president of the United States, how would you do it? I would think that first, you might start by harming the country's reputation around the world. By, for example, engaging in a war against a country that didn't offer any threat to you. You'd try to destroy the middle class of the country. You would ship all the good jobs overseas and encourage that, and encourage in the United States just you know, low-paying jobs, wipe out the middle class. You would do away with the industrial infrastructure so that we couldn't build weapons if we ever had to. In World War II, the first years of World War II, we have, by the way, been in Iraq longer than we were in World War II. During the time we were in World War II, we were able to take a domestic infrastructure, take our steel mills, take our tool and die shops, take our domestic infrastructure and use it to make military stuff. We can't do that anymore. We don't have any domestic infrastructure. You would try to bankrupt the country if you were the Manchurian Candidate. You would cut taxes on the wealthy, you'd cut taxes right across the board, and you would borrow until the country was so bankrupt that the country that you were actually representing, let's say, for example, it was China, since Manchuria is in China, that the country that you were actually representing suddenly owned your country, that they could destroy the United States economically if they just stopped buying its bonds. I'm telling you, we have the Manchurian Candidate here right now. His name is George W. Bush. He's been put in office to destroy the United States, him and his handmaidens in the right-wing media, and they are doing it. They are doing it. We got to do something about it. It's time to wake up and get active, my friends. 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Panama, Appaloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Topeka, Blanchill, Amadil, I'm a killer, I've been everywhere.
I think so far I've been to all those places. I've also been to Reykjavik and Keflavik. Welcome back, my friends. Speaking of Reykjavik and Keflavik, on the telephone, Kola in Iceland.
Hi, I'm calling from Reykjavik. My name is Kola.
You have a beautiful city. Louise and I, the first time we were there was 25 years ago. It's just a marvelous
place.
Well,
you should come back. It's nice and sunny.
Is it? I love the weather there in the summer.
Yeah.
In the winter, it's a little grim. Louise says there was grass on the lava.
Oh, really?
I think not. But in any you have lava instead of grass in places. So, Cola, what are you calling about?
Well, I'm sharing your concern about the direction that the United States foreign policy is taking the entire world into.
How is this affecting Iceland?
Well, we have a we are allies of NATO, and we have a military base here, the Navy. And obviously we have a certain dependence on the military base here, as far as about 2,500 people are working there or something.
Yeah. And how is America perceived, and how is George Bush perceived in Iceland?
As you know, we're one of the willing, although about 95% of the population is against the war in Iraq.
Do you know how many troops you have in Iraq?
We?
Iceland?
Iceland doesn't have.
Oh, it doesn't. I thought you said you were part of the coalition of the willing.
Yeah. I mean, we signed up for the, to protect our interests as far as,
Oh, I see. Yeah.
As far as the base is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, only two guys that, took that decision, that decision in a dark room, a smoke-filled dark room.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cola, what's the message that you would want to share with our American
listeners? Well, it's like, you're talking about the workers and as far as I'm concerned, the most valuable resource that you have is like the manpower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that's what you have to really build up and train to have a good working base. And this is what, the United States doesn't really realize. They feel they can just take the companies, all over the world where they can find the cheapest labor without really training them. And what really concerns me is like, all these lame people are controlling the government, and you have so many other really good, resourceful, and intelligent people that could be doing it. And I don't understand why they're not there.
It sounds like it sounds like the Bush administration is causing you some fear or angst.
Yeah, it does, because I have family out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really concerned about what direction he's taken the world into, and I'm really concerned.
I travel a fair amount, and I've done a lot of speaking in Europe, and I get the sense around the world actually that your concerns are shared by many people around the world, that they view George Bush as, how did you Americans do this? How could this have happened? How could you have been so dumb to, that kind of thing? That's the view. The answer, I don't have an answer to the question. I'm sorry. It happened. He lied us into it. Maybe he rigged the voting machines. We don't know. But at the very least, he lied us into
it. That's obvious. He must have done that. And it's pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
And, it's like this ruthless man, it's awful.
Yeah.
It's really awful.
Well,
and I hope, you have to really get people working on, getting your country back and making the world safe.
There you
go. He's the biggest terrorist of all.
Well, there are some who say that. I'm reluctant to say that, but terror tactics are certainly being used. And
yeah, well, you're trying to be modest,
Yeah, well, it's not so much that I'm trying to be politic. It's that the definition of the word terrorist has a very specific meaning here. But George W. Bush is using terror. I mean, they're raising the terror alert throughout the election, for example, to try and throw John Kerry off stride. It was one of his favorite strategies. Cola, thank you for the call. I appreciate it, and for sharing your perspective with the rest of our listeners here in the United States. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. What
was it you wanted? How about democracy?
Again, so I know.
Democracy!
What's happening in there? What's going on in your show?
Well, what's happened is Bush has hijacked the voting machines and...
say it again.
Yeah, he hijacked the voting machines.
I'll be back in a minute. You can get it together by then.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894 on this beautiful Friday. Our telephone number, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom Hartman, a man after my own heart, first-time caller.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling. Great to hear from you. What's up?
First thing, I want to thank you for your great, in my opinion, your great contribution to America.
Well, thank you. I have to say, I'm doing this for two reasons, and really two reasons only. And the first and foremost one is that I'm having a lot of fun doing it. So that's a very selfish reason. And the second reason is...
No, it's not.
Well, I think, you know, I'm always suspicious of people who say that they're motivated by anything else. I used to do international
airport. Oh, true.
And
I
remember sitting around in Africa one time in Namalu, Uganda, in the middle of a refugee camp where people were starving all around us. And this one guy was going on and on and on about how this was his Christian duty to do and he was going to go to heaven and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, you know, there's something else there. And somebody said, you know, why are you here? And I said, because this energizes me. This makes me feel like I'm alive. And that's why I did international relief work. That's why I'm doing radio work, number one. And number two, I want to take my country back. I want my children and grandchildren to have the kinds of opportunity that I had and even better. I want this country to realize its potential. And the conservatives are destroying this country.
I guess a person who's most honest with themselves gets furthest in life, too.
Well, sometimes, yeah. It depending on how you define furthest, I would say George.
Well,
Bush
furthest in the sense of moving America forward.
Yeah, hopefully. So, Gary, what's on your mind?
I remember George Bush, and I want to quote the president, and I'm going to say, in all due respect, that I mean that. However, here's what he said. 1990. I have a vision beyond profit or loss. Well, Mr. President, you've let us down.
Well, I would say it was his speechwriter who wrote that, not him, you know, first of all.
Well, I am an FDR Democrat. I'm a liberal. I've always have been. And I remember FDR saying this, if I may say this. May I?
Sure.
FDR said this, "We have earned the hatred of entrenched greed." And I believe that's exactly what's going on in the United States of America. It is so entrenched, so deep, that I wonder if we can figure our way out of this.
Well, I think that we can, ultimately, and I think, that, you know, frankly, that we must. But you're right. In fact, Franklin, FDR, you know, went well beyond just the hatred of entrenched greed. In fact, thank you for providing me with an opportunity to share with our listeners some clips from FDR, which I'm going to do in just a moment, Gary.
May I say, I'm sorry, sir.
Sure.
May I just finish it with
yes.
the greatest quote?
Okay.
Sure. Am I an FDR fan? I always have been. Can I just finish with a quote from FDR, and
if
then I'll get out of the way?
If it's short.
Well, government can err, presidents can make mistakes, but we are told that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and sins of the warm-hearted on a different scale. Better the occasional fault of a government living in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
Yes, that's from his speech in 1936 in Philadelphia on July 27th, as I recall, when
I'll
he accepted
done.
The nomination of his party for his second term as President of the United States. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Tom.
Gary, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Marianne in Arcadia on the line. Hey, Marianne.
In Arcata. Yeah.
Arcata, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I think your program is just so amazing. You give us history and facts and wisdom.
Well, thank you.
And here they're calling from Iceland. I bet you nobody's calling Rush Limbaugh's program from Iceland.
Well, you never know.
That's what I'm calling about. You know, I don't listen to him, but the CBS station happened to be on the dial when I turned my radio on the other day, and there was Rush Limbaugh, and he was actually reading, I think it was an AP story about the latest assault in Iraq, and I guess when the 14 Marines died, and then it said also in that story that the casualties are now up and above 1,800.
Yes.
So Rush Limbaugh's astounding but not surprising comment was, and I quote, "It is sick that people are keeping a body count on this." That's what he said, you know. In other words, don't mind the numbers. Just make sure Halliburton makes their money on the war, but don't talk about the casualties.
Yeah, you're right, Marianne. Marianne, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it very much. It's just, this is, Yeah, and in fact, what you have to understand is that Limbaugh's agenda, the entire Reich Wing's agenda, is not ultimately about war or peace. War or peace is you know, a nice means to the end. Their agenda is to roll back Franklin Roosevelt's work, because Roosevelt dared to have the same vision that Thomas Jefferson had, which was a nation of, by, and for its own people. And the same vision, by the way, I would suggest that the Republican Abraham Lincoln had back during that brief 18-20-year interval when the Republican Party was actually the party of reform, from 1856, when it was created in Jackson, Michigan, up until the early 1870s, late 1860s, when it disintegrated and essentially got bought out from within by the railroads. But Limbaugh's agenda, pure and simple, very straightforward, unambiguous, you know, no two ways about it, is to undo the New Deal. This is what these guys are all about. This is, you know, you got Janice Rogers Brown. Why did they want to get Janice Rogers Brown on the Supreme Court so badly? Why was it such a big deal to have Janice Rogers Brown on? Because she said, 1937, you know, when Social Security was passed, was the high point of our socialist revolution. These guys viewed the Roosevelt Democrats, the traditional liberal progressive view of America, as articulated by Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, as communism. In fact, here's Limbaugh in his own words.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
We're in the process of doing something about that as well. Now, what did Roosevelt actually say? Here, this is from his 1936 speech when he accepted the nomination of his party in Philadelphia. And as I recall, July 27th, 1936. And first, Franklin Roosevelt talks about the power of the new aristocracy. First of all, about how, you know, what is freedom and how did we get away from the old aristocracy?
That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power.
What might that power be?
In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists, who held special privileges from the crown.
But now Roosevelt suggests a new aristocracy has arisen that we must confront.
But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free.
Like us.
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties.
And this is the key. He identified. This is Franklin Roosevelt coming right out and saying it. Where are the Democrats today who will say this? I mean, Bernie Sanders will say this. Where are the Democrats who will say this? The new royalists are the economic royalists. Roosevelt continues.
New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers. The whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service.
And this royal service was not satisfied just with money.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
And it wasn't enough just to control the marketplace. They actually wanted to reach out and control the government itself. And that's what Limbaugh and the cons are about.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
Yes, and from economic slavery then comes control, again, of governance.
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
And his right to live. And so we must confront these economic royalists.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
Now here, this is the most important quote in the entire... Just listen carefully. In fact, I'm going to start it over right at the beginning of this little piece here.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance and our allegiance to American institutions
requires
the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. We must stand up to this kind of power if we're going to have democracy in the United States. As Franklin Roosevelt says,
in vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
And, of course, they're doing it again. Oh, flag-burning amendments. We're more patriotic than you are. We wear flags on our lapels.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And this is where he points out the flag and the Constitution don't just stand for preventing mob rule. They stand for preventing rule by the privileged and the powerful as well. In other words, democracy. As I'll let Roosevelt say, he says it better than I do.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
There you have it, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1936, nominated for his second term as president, which he won overwhelmingly. And I'm telling you, if there are people in the Democratic Party listening, you contrast that with the conservatives' mantra,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And, of course, the conservatives' response to anybody who would dare speak up on these issues.
Well, the shut-up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing?
Shut
I'm
up.
I'm asking you to shut up about
sex.
What?
Listen. Cut his mic.
No,
hey, shut up.
No,
you had your
up.
35 minutes. Shut up.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. Okay. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
Yeah, well said. And there's the perfect contrast. I mean, it's just, you know, take your choice. Do you want Enron running the show? Or do you want we, the people, running the show? Do you want the economic royalists or not? Let's have our Enron moment.
Just before our stock did tank, we sold and took it to the bank. The workers still got screwed. It was our intention to build the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron.
Yes, we're
With
Enron.
Dick Cheney.
For us.
He's working for us, oh, Enron. We're Enron. When Dick Cheney,
yeah,
Democratic royalists think they've taken over the United States of America. See, MSNBC's rule that if you have a liberal on, you have to have two conservatives on. National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, being turned into the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting. Bill Moyers and now getting the axe. Tucker Carlson being brought. They're all sitting around going, yep, but we got it. We got the whole country. We got the energy bill passed. We got billions of dollars, $9 billion for the energy industry. Yes, indeed. Oh, we got hundreds of billions of dollars that we can make in Iraq. $100,000 a year we'll pay people to go over to Iraq. We get the armored vehicles. We get the Rhino vehicles. Nah, don't give them to the soldiers. They're just the grunts. No, it's for the contractors. They're the ones who get. But it's all paid for with tax dollars. So what? Doesn't matter. If those tax dollars are going to a private corporation, we get armor. If they're going to the Army, or the Marine Corps, screw it. That is the conservative way, my friends. The Republican way. And I'm telling you, America is waking up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. And other things just make you swear and curse.
Like Bush.
When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life.
Yes, always look on the bright side of life. It's actually very, very good advice. It's much better to be thinking about what you can do about something than to be sitting around stewing, thinking about, oh, I can't do this. This was Bernie's point in the first hour about, you know, conspiracy machine theories and voting machines. And I'm right out, you know, I'm there. But still, we can't say, oh, therefore we have to throw up our hands. No, therefore we have to get active. We have to get energized. And looking at the bright side of things, well, you know, kind of the downside is that there is this real mentality among the cons these days that we're either with them or against them. You know, you're either with Bush or you're against America. You're either good and with Bush or you're evil. For example,
either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, and then you got, you know, national commentators saying, if you're going to exercise free speech in a way that may undermine the Bush administration's policies, you're a traitor.
Because you must know the difference between dissent from the Iraq war and a war on terror and undermining it. And any American that undermines that war with our soldiers in the field or undermines the war on terror with 3,000 dead on 9/11 is a traitor.
There you go. And in fact, a traitor? Yeah, let's lock him up. Let's throw him in chains. Anybody who speaks out against George W. Bush, obviously giving aid and comfort to the enemy is traitor. But that's not quite what O'Reilly's talking about. What he's talking about is exercising your First Amendment rights.
But he got it? Dissent? Fine. Undermining? You're a traitor.
In other words, talk show hosts, for example, who speak out and say George Bush lied us into a war, they should go to prison. Nah, Bill Riley would never say that.
Got it. So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah. And on that bright note, I'll tell you, in St. Louis, they've figured out the geese are pests. And so they got a spay and neuter program for the geese. Maybe we should think about something like that for Republican talk show hosts. No. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to Shelby at RadioPower.org and Ben at White Rose Society for streaming our programs and podcasting them. To Louise for producing the program. For all the folks who have called in and who listen to the radio stations that carry our program and to our great sponsors, please patronize them. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.